I'm now going to introduce one of my colleagues from the Legal Department, Legal Affairs, and this is Richard Fontana, and he's going to talk about open source license compliance. Richard, are you on the phone?
I am on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Well, let me turn it over to you and tell us all about it.
Okay. I'm Richard Fontana. I am my title at Red Hat is Open Source Licensing and Patent Counsel. I'm in the Intellectual Property Group in our little legal department at Red Hat. And I've been at Red Hat for a couple of years. Before coming to Red Hat, I worked at a public interest law firm called the Software Freedom Law Center, where I principally represented the Free Software Foundation, and most of that time was participating in the drafting of GPL version 3. So that's kind of where I cut my teeth on free software and open source licensing, and now I concentrate in that area at Red Hat. I don't know what the background of the people listening to the session is. When I decided to do a session on open source licensing, I just repurposed some material that I've given a few times as a presentation to lawyers who have some familiarity with open source, but not that much. I don't know if that kind of material is that appropriate for the listeners to this session, but so I'll probably try to make it more high level than the slides would suggest. But anyway, so if we could go on to the next slide. I'm just going to talk about a little bit about history and defining free software and open source. Then, to some degree, I think this is just going to be a kind of open source licensing 101 talk. But I'll try to get into some issues of enforcement and compliance from the perspective of companies, but also from the perspective of projects, and I kind of get both perspectives in my work at Red Hat. Next slide, please. So one thing that may not be obvious if you're not familiar with the history of free software is that this is very old. Programmers, developers have been sharing code under basically unrestricted terms. That's how it started out, since the very beginning of the computing industry. The computing industry started out sort of dominated by hardware vendors and research institutions. Software was not considered a form of property at first, and that's what's very interesting about all this. Software gradually became proprietized as the law evolved over several decades. And so certain areas of law that we generally call intellectual property, but they really involve very different areas of the law, were applied to software over time. And they were sort of taken from other areas of activity, for example, literature or hardware manufacturing, and applied to software, which is a very new concept. And so, originally I'd say that the state of nature for software was freedom. Developers shared freely with one another, and this was intentional, and this was sort of by design of the hardware vendors who, in a sense, were making a lot of software available to user communities. But over time, it became clear in the law that you could apply copyright law to software, and this was very much clear by the end of the 1970s. That you could have a trade secret protection in software that you source code, let's say, that you don't make available publicly. And later on, that you could get patents, which are rights and inventions, on functionality implemented in software. So once these are called exclusive rights, these intellectual property legal regimes. And basically, they're systems of property rights that say, you know, you get the right to exclude others from doing certain activities that you are given. So in copyright law, which is the most important for open source licensing. You know, the copyright holder has the exclusive right to make copies and distribute and make derivative works based on the material that's copyrighted. And so if you have the exclusive right over those things, you can then license some of those activities to other parties. And that's where, once it became clear that these areas of the law could be applied to software, to kind of control software, then that enabled business models that we think of now as commercial proprietary software business models to develop based on licensing. So the software industry as we know it today really was only made possible once exclusive property rights regimes were applied to software. And once that happened, really almost as soon as that got going, there was a reaction against that development by the people from the very communities that had been sharing code with each other all along. And what was different now is in the past that they just sort of put that code into the public domain. They didn't claim copyright on it. It wasn't clear that they could claim copyright on it. After the proprietary licensing business models got started, these developers reacting against that development began to use licenses themselves, copyright licenses, in order to, instead of restricting or only providing very limited rights to users, granting instead very broad rights to distribute and to modify. And this was done to encourage collaboration and improvement. Distributed improvement and widespread adoption, which were the very things that were accomplished during the previous era when software was not considered property. Next slide, please. So that's the kind of how historically free software and open source, as it was later called, got started. And in this, I think in this presentation, I'll try to use the term open source. There are a lot of terms that are used today. Free software was originally championed by the Free Software Foundation, and it's still used by many people. Open source was kind of coined at the end of the 90s, and it's dominant in the commercial world. There are acronyms that are popular nowadays, FOSS and FLOSS, that attempt to kind of unify these different terms. I take the position that these are supposed to mean the same thing, and that's how I use them. So fundamentally, it's important to think about what the definition of open source is. And there is so there's no single objective canonical definition of this concept. I take the position that it's really a kind of social phenomenon or a culture that has developed through time and by developers in communities, in software development communities. And by using particular licenses and engaging in particular distribution practices, these communities of developers have articulated through that activity notions of what free software and open source means. And that's where these definitions and boundaries of what is FLOSS or open source and what is not come from. So as I say, there is not a single objective definition. There's a kind of anthropological definition that you can derive from looking at what these communities accept and don't accept, and that's something that changes over time. To give you an example, I think at the very beginnings of free software licensing, it wasn't clear that whether commercial exploitation of software was a value that was a sort of fundamental value that was going to be protected by these licenses. But it pretty soon was realized by consensus, and this is really going back to the 1980s, that it was very important to allow commercial use of software under these licenses as a fundamental right. And so licenses that don't allow commercial use, and there are licenses out there that aren't really commercial licenses, or obviously not commercial licenses, but they aren't really proprietary licenses as we usually think of them, but there are licenses out there that seem to be community licenses, but they don't allow commercial use. Some of these are produced by some companies, some by actual project communities. I don't consider those open source, and I think it's important to this is where I can't really be objective about this. I think it's very important to have strict boundaries and apply strict rules about what is or isn't open source, because I think it's important to keep clear standards because this serves as the legal underpinning of all of this activity that's so important to so many of us. So the boundaries are articulated by communities, and there are organizations that have been very influential in this. The Free Software Foundation has a free software definition, and this is a sort of four-plank definition that attempts to determine whether a particular software license is free or not. And there's the Debian Linux distribution project, which has a 10-plank set of free software guidelines. There's the Open Source Initiative, which has an open source definition derived from the Debian free software guidelines. And one organization that, as a Red Hat lawyer, I have some involvement in is the Fedora Project, which a lot of the activity I do with the Fedora Project involves this sort of gatekeeper function where so Fedora is a very large, in terms of the number of packages, large Linux distribution, but it has very strict legal guidelines. And Fedora does not wish to distribute any software that does not meet the FSF's free software definition. And so this involves really kind of applying that definition to particular novel software licenses and seeing whether it meets the definition or not. And so Fedora, I think, is playing an important role today, and other distributions are using Fedora's lists of good and bad licenses. And also, all this activity is very important, in my opinion, as a kind of forming a bedrock, a legal bedrock for what open source is and is not. Next slide, please. So I like to kind of attempt my own definition rather than rely on those, which are very important. I think what they're kind of getting at is that there are two aspects of what makes some particular software in a particular distribution context open source or not. And there's a legal and a technical aspect of this. So legally, there has to be a license that attaches to the software that is very permissive. It basically does not practically limit internal use. Now, some licenses certainly can be read to place some requirements, even if you don't distribute the software. But as a practical matter, these aren't enforced, and I think this is understood. So private use is basically unlimited. Distribution, and in some cases other forms of public use, are limited, but only in certain ways that the community believes is, you know, doesn't cross the line into what's conflicting with notions of software freedom. And I recognize that's a circular definition, that free software is whatever is not unduly burdensome to software freedom, in a sense. But that reflects the fact that this is really a social concept that evolves over time. And so in addition to the license, which is the legal aspect, there's the technical. So the software has to either be distributed in source code form, or else, if you're distributing object code under a nominally open source license, you have to have either immediate access to the source code under a free software license, or there has to be some way of readily getting that source code in a way that the license provides for. So this, in a sense, reflects the fact that the GPL2, which is the most widely used license in this area, does allow for the possibility of providing source code on request within certain boundaries defined by the license. Next slide, please. So given that definition, there are certain basic categories of open source licenses. I prefer to use the terminology of that the Free Software Foundation has popularized. Basically, there are two divisions. There's copyleft and what I usually call permissive. And copyleft is further subdivided into strong and weak, strong copyleft and weak copyleft. Next slide, please. So copyleft, which was a term that was popularized, if not coined, by Richard Stallman of the FSF, copyleft licenses have the common feature that they limit the licensee, the user, from distributing derivative works of the software under more restrictive terms, and, you know, potentially non-free terms, compared to the original license. Usually these licenses also require, if you're distributing a binary, they require you to provide source code, or at least some subset of the source code that went into making that or building that binary. And typically, copyleft licenses require that at least the source code has to be under the same license that you got from the upstream copyright holder. Next slide, please. So the GPL is the most important. So strong copyleft is really synonymous with the GPL. And the GPL is the most important open source license. It's by far the most widely used one. It's GPL version 2. GPL version 3 is a license that has been around for a few years. It's pretty popular for a new license, but it's not nearly as widely adopted yet as GPL version 2. Strong copyleft is synonymous with either version of the GPL. There's also another new license that the FSF has published called the Afero GPL, which is used in especially in web application contexts. The policy goal of strong copyleft and the GPL is to preserve. So you remember I talked about the fact that in the sort of prehistory of software, there was a de facto free software commons, a non-proprietary commons that developers would participate in, and you know they would share code with each other and improve code. And the GPL is trying to really recreate that. In a sense, it's a reaction against the development of proprietary software, particularly proprietary software that builds upon free software. So the GPL uses copyleft to make sure that software that is originally released as free software stays free, even as it evolves downstream through further distribution and further modification. So improvements to the software, if they are released by the user that's improving the software, they have to be free software as well. And that's really the fundamental feature of strong copyleft. The reason why it's called strong, well, it's sort of, I'll get into what weak copyleft is, but it relates to the way that the GPL has been interpreted, especially by the FSF, but probably by most other GPL-using communities over time, that there's a very strong belief that copyleft applies to this sort of notion of the whole work, that you can't easily circumvent the requirement, the copyleft requirements, through packaging techniques or by separating modules out. So you can't put your improvements into a library and have the library be linked to the what's more or less the original code and say that the whole thing is not under the GPL. That's the interpretation that we think of as strong copyleft. So circumvention of the copyleft requirement is certainly possible, but it's intended to be burdensome to do that. So the FSF says, for example, that you can put your improvements into a separate program and run that program as a separate process and invoke that process from the program that we gave you. And that separate process, that program does not have to be under the GPL. But that in a sense, is a certain deters you from trying to engaging in that effort to get around the GPL's requirements. Next slide, please. So there are a few basic requirements in the GPL, and the GPL is important to focus on because it is so widely used and because other categories of licenses really have, in a sense, were popularized in reaction to the GPL. So that's just to sort of justify why I would spend a fair amount of time on it. The first aspect of what the GPL requires is that if you distribute a version that you modify, you put that under the GPL. So you've taken some upstream GPL software, you've made some changes to it, and you want to distribute it to others. You can do that, but it has to be under the GPL. And there's a near aggregation clause in the GPL that clarifies that if two completely separate pieces of software can be distributed together and there are no licensing implications. Another important part of the GPL is this prohibition against further restrictions. So if you distribute GPL software, you can't make the license more restrictive than the GPL. That's another kind of corollary to copyleft. And there's something we call the Liberty or Death Clause. That's probably a slide presentation in itself, but that's a noteworthy provision of the GPL that basically says that if you're distributing GPL software as a licensee, you cannot impose on your distributees contradictory requirements or obligations merely because you had to enter or you entered into some relationship or agreement with a third party. So for example, if you enter into an agreement with a third party patent holder and your patent license says that, you know, you can distribute this GPL software, but that software, you have to collect royalties from your downstream users, that would violate the GPL because the GPL, like other free software licenses, does not permit imposition of royalty requirements on downstream users. And the third important requirement of the GPL is that if you distribute binaries, you have to provide a complete corresponding source, which has to be licensed under the GPL. So that's the questions arise of how much source code do you have to provide, often what I hear developers experienced in the GPL talk about is that it has to be whatever source code is necessary for a developer to rebuild the binary, in a sense the amount of source code that you have to provide is more or less what the scope of the GPL copyleft requirement is. That's sort of approximately true, at least. Next slide, please. So lawyers, at least, who get interested in the GPL like to talk about this issue of copyleft scope. How much, in a sense, the issue is how far can you go in trying to circumvent the GPL's copyleft requirement, the strong copyleft requirement. And where this arises is, software is generally developed by combining different modular components and the question arises, are there circumstances under which you could have some component that is proprietary or under some other license that conflicts with the GPL without violating the GPL copyleft if you're also using components that upstream were distributed to you under the GPL? And this is actually, in my view, not a very important issue in terms of legal risk. That's something I try to get across to lawyers. It can be very important to project developers and I think it's rightfully important because they're trying to create a coherent legal system. And I've often talked about that in other talks. But it's not that this really has that much to do with true legal risk, and that's partly because the companies who might think about trying to circumvent the GPL generally conclude that it's not worth it. The companies that get in trouble and get sued for GPL violations or are the target of enforcement actions generally do so, in a sense, unintentionally. They have not intentionally tried to fall afoul of the GPL. Another important point is that the Free Software Foundation, which originally published the GPL, it's no longer the majority copyright holder of GPL licensed software. That hasn't been true since the early 90s. But they continue to be really play this role of authoritative license interpreters in the free software and open source community. And their views, they take a fairly strong view on this notion of copyleft scope, although not as strong as some people seem to think. Alternative interpretations of the GPL have generally not caught on, and that's partly because developers who disagreed with the policy choices of the FSF tended to adopt or create other licensing models. Next slide, please. That brings me to the next category of copyleft, which is weak copyleft. And this is another important family of category of open source licenses. And these were kind of a response, at least originally, to criticism of the strong copyleft policy in the GPL. The FSF started out putting some of their libraries under the GPL, And many developers complained about this because they wanted to use those libraries in proprietary software. And the FSF, for policy reasons, decided, you know, that was, it was worth kind of compromising on their ideals and allowing that. And they, so they wrote a license called the LGPL in the early 90s. And that's, the LGPL is now one of the, also one of the most widely used open source licenses. There are other licenses that fall into this category of weak copyleft that are widely used, and the Mozilla public license is one of them. There are many licenses based on the MPL, most importantly the CDDL or CUDA license of Sun Microsystems. There's the Eclipse public license and some other licenses originally promoted by IBM that are another important family in this area. So the common feature of this category is copyleft scope is more or less explicitly carved back from what it's assumed to be in the GPL context. So I talked about this notion of the whole work, that copyleft applies to the whole work that you create when you modify GPL license software and build upon it. In the weak copyleft licenses, the whole work is not relevant. It's only, in a sense, it's, there's a kind of, I think of it as an honor system. You know, if you got source code under the LGPL, you modify those individual source files, your modifications are governed by the LGPL. But if those files are, the code in those files are used in larger works, those larger works don't have to be under the LGPL. So the copyleft doesn't extend to those. And this is also explicit in the other weak copyleft licenses. Next slide, please. Another feature of these licenses is they allow explicitly, in a sense, it follows from what I just said, they allow you to distribute proprietary executables that incorporate code that's under the weak copyleft license. And the third big category is the permissive family. In a sense, these licenses are, they're very simple, they're very permissive, they have very few requirements. They're not too far from pure public domain, and in a sense, they continue the tradition of public domain software sharing that predates the GPL. To some degree, the communities that use these licenses chose them self-consciously because they didn't agree with the GPL's policies. So the policy goals of these licenses is to, you know, certainly freedom, but in a sense, freedom is more, in a sense, more fundamental. The freedom of the immediate user is more fundamental than the freedom of the larger community. So these licenses allow you to distribute derivative works, at least, under more restrictive terms, which could be proprietary, or GPL in some cases. They generally have notice requirements. You have to preserve legal notices, in some cases attribution notices, but they don't require you to provide source code if you're distributing binaries. Often, though, there is a social expectation for some of these projects that you, if you're taking advantage of these very generous licenses, you should really contribute some of your improvements upstream to the projects that made that code available. So next slide, please. So just I guess I touched on license enforcement already. So now everyone assumes that open source licenses in general are legally enforceable, just as any other software license might be assumed to be legally enforceable. There was a recent case, Jacobson v. Katzer, which actually provided some, for the first time in the United States, a kind of legal support for this view that you could, that these are copyright licenses that are enforceable through copyright infringement lawsuits. In a sense, though, there's critics of open source, and I think lawyers advising clients that are new to open source tend to take a very risk-averse view of all this, and to some degree there's been fear, uncertainty, and doubt over the years regarding open source from software companies that support competing kinds of licensing models. And so there is a kind of perception that there is that there's something very dangerous about open source. In fact, what I think is remarkable about this area is how little litigation there has been under these licenses, that there's actually been very little litigation, very little enforcement even outside of the court system. For the most part, enforcement and policing of these licenses that occurs is restricted to the GPL, the projects using the GPL. There are exceptions to that, but it's mostly the GPL. It's largely a small group of licensors that are actively policing their licenses. In a sense, you know, you could say that the rest of the GPL licensing universe, the developers in that universe, rely on these active enforcers of the GPL to shape behavior. But it's also true that there's a tradition of, non-confrontational enforcement. So compliance with these licenses is really more a matter of, I think, ethics and good community relations and an expectation of voluntary compliance than some sort of atmosphere of hostile enforcement, which I think is the impression that one not familiar with this culture might get. The GPL litigation that has occurred in recent years has also notably been limited to a certain context, mainly vendors of embedded devices that have firmware that generally the vendor doesn't even know is based in part on GPL licensed software. So it's a very specific kind of area of what I would consider bad practices. Next slide, please. I certainly, when I talk to other lawyers and companies that are concerned about, you know, their obligations under open source licenses, I like to get the point across that this is really more than anything else about trying to figure out what the expectations are of the upstream copyright holders, the upstream developers, and trying as far as possible to meet those expectations. And generally, this is not difficult if you adopt good practices. Understanding expectations is important. Also, becoming good community members is very important. If a company is using open source software, particularly under a license like the GPL, and is concerned about enforcement, what they should do is develop contacts with those upstream communities that are providing the software that they're benefiting from and develop good relationships with them. And actually, they should participate in those communities. And this is certainly what many companies do, but I think more companies making use of GPL license software should be doing that. Next slide, please. I probably should wrap up pretty soon, and as I expected, I'm not really getting to a lot of the detail in these slides, but my view is that that compliance with open source licenses is easy as long as you do your homework in advance. So once you figure out what the license terms are when you're using code from other sources, and as long as you do that early enough in the process of your product development, or if you're a project of your project development. This is equally applicable to companies developing software commercially and to upstream community projects that are making use of other projects' code. As long as you do this early on and you are careful to figure out what the terms are, it's really almost a routine mechanical matter to comply with these licenses. Companies especially should adopt good software development practices to aid in their compliance with applicable licenses. So there are still some companies, as my friend Bradley Kuhn often points out in his talks on GPL enforcement, there are still companies that don't use version control when in their internal software development. Version control is really necessary if you're trying to comply with the GPL and you have to figure out what source code is the complete and corresponding source code to some binary release that you are distributing. Next slide, please. So it's important to be able to exercise due diligence in code that is third-party code that you're taking in, whether you're a project or a company or a vendor, you should be able to know where it comes from, what terms it is under. You should, you know, so the problem of the embedded device vendors who get in trouble with GPL licensors is that they have sourced firmware from third parties upstream without really investigating into the origins of that firmware. So they don't realize that the firmware was built in part out of GPL licensed software in a non-compliant fashion. And I think that there is a growing move to really correct this this problem in that area of the industry. Next slide, please. So I especially tell lawyers who are involved in this area that they need to develop some engineering skills to do this kind of due diligence work. So, but this is sort of equally true of developers. It's just that they really have the skills already, or they should. So you really can find out a lot of information about code, as long as you have the source code, by analyzing it. And there are certain conventional kinds of files that you look at, and you know, source files conventionally may have copyright notices and license notices in them. There may be other files in a source distribution that contain licensing information. And if you become familiar with this world, you learn to look for those things. It's also important for lawyers who are not technically minded to try to understand how software is built and to understand, you know, to try to come to grips with a version control repository and to figure out who committed what when. This is all very important to trying to analyze what the kind of ownership and licensing structure of software is. So I think given the time, I won't go into the remaining slides. They focus on, you know, the kind of mechanics for complying with the GPL. And these are fairly straightforward. And I'd be happy to provide my slides to anyone who would like to have them and make use of them. My email address is rfontana@redhat.com. And so I think I will leave it there. And if there are any questions in the remaining time, I'd be happy to answer them.
Richard, thank you so much. There is a question that came in from the room here, which fundamentally asks the question whether the principal legal theories behind the patent and copyright clause of the U.S. Constitution versus inherent ownership theories of European law, whether you really do see a difference between the way that Europeans, Americans, and other you know, legal systems approach and understand the GPL, or whether it is a uniformly interpreted document around the world.
So I would say it's not uniformly interpreted, but we like to, in a sense this is off topic, but we like to pretend that it's uniformly interpreted, because and that's actually an interesting thing, that we have all these different jurisdictions with different regimes of copyright law, but we really have to try to imagine that they all are harmonized. I do see some differences in the way European lawyers approach these issues compared to American lawyers. I find that European lawyers they come from somewhat more formalistic traditions of legal, of jurisprudence, and so they, in the U.S., there are traditions of, there's a tradition of something called legal realism that has really influenced my understanding of these kinds of issues a lot, and you kind of could get that from my presentation a little bit, that you know, the licenses, the text of the licenses don't really tell you the whole story, that there are customs and traditions behind the way these licenses are used by communities that really are the key to understanding how they're interpreted. And but beyond that, I don't know if there's really a fundamental difference based on the fact that we have a copyright and patent clause in our Constitution, and that there are other legal differences in European jurisdictions. For example, there's concepts of moral rights in European law that don't really apply to software in U.S. copyright law. There are differences among lawyers, but I think it's actually very important to try to harmonize interpretations, and the key to doing that is to view community custom and tradition as the key to license interpretation.
Great. Speaking of our friends over in Europe, I think that the EUPL just recently went through yet another round of I don't know the correct exact term, but I think what was it that happened a couple of weeks ago with the EUPL? There was some, I think, that went through one more gate of acceptance within the European community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I don't remember. But the EUPL is an interesting exercise in creating a document that could be interpreted consistently across all 27 countries and I think 23 languages that it was translated into. We often rely on one single language as the language of expression of a contract, and here they've got multiple languages.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So most open source licenses are written in English, and actually, I guess, American English, and that is a problem in a sense because they're used by people with other primary languages and in jurisdictions where there are languages other than English that are used for legal communication. The need to kind of take account of differences in different jurisdictions is something that is an interesting feature of GPL version 3. So GPL version 3 defines the certain terms by reference to local copyright law very explicitly. I actually think this, in a sense, this has so far been kind of ignored or hasn't been an important part of interpretation of GPL 3 because this tradition of kind of trying to assume that there is a kind of international, transnational interpretation of licenses that are used across different countries is so important to this, what I think of as an open source legal system.
Right. So there's one question that just came in from online, and this question really concerns the question of, what is the bright line that distinguishes a distribution and causes the GPL to apply? In other words, when one is dealing with multinationals, what is an amount of transfer that constitutes an internal versus an external distribution act?
Right. This is a question that I've heard come up quite a bit. I think if you try to research the question under your local system of copyright law, you'll have trouble finding the answer. I don't really know what the formal answer is under U.S. copyright law. I do know, however, that the Free Software Foundation, and again, remember I said that the FSF has been a kind of moral interpretive authority on what the GPL means, which is a very important role. The FSF says, look, whatever local copyright law really says, and, I guess it's whatever we said in GPL version 3, which refers to local copyright law, we don't think that, a simple transfer of code from a parent to a subsidiary should be considered distribution for purposes of these licenses. So I think, again, what the law says is less important than the kind of, in a sense, this issue of common sense, that whether it's distribution or not, in that kind of setting, no one's going to argue that you gave a binary but you didn't provide source code to your subsidiary and that you're going to somehow get in trouble for that. But from time to time I hear lawyers wondering about that and, I guess, worrying about that issue. But I think it sort of illustrates the fact that it's really, you have to kind of start out with a sort of common sense approach to interpreting these licenses. They're not these dangerous traps. They're designed, again, to encourage sharing and collaboration, and they're very forgiving in a sense. And I think that point is often missed by those who are kind of approaching this area of software and law for the first time.
I think that's actually a great thought to leave people with. That's certainly been my experience over 20-plus years, is that typically, the conventionally constructed proprietary license is all about exclusion, and it's all about limitation, and open-source licenses, free software in particular, are about granting freedoms, and they do have that forgiving property in it. And from what I have seen, those who have run afoul have really been the egregious actors, not those who were simply unaware.
Exactly.
Great. Well, we have reached a point where we can take a break, and so we will, as Richard promised, but all the speakers have permitted, we will be sharing our slides at the end of this forum, and the audios will also be available for replay. But we're going to take a 15-minute break, resuming at 4 o'clock, when Open Source for America will talk about what they are doing. And so until that time, you will hear some lovely hold music, and we'll be back with you at 4 o'clock. So stay tuned. Thank you very much.